Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
the award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Right now is one of the most important times in the 26-year history of Joy. Times are tough financially, but that will never stop us delivering powerful, meaningful, and uplifting radio for you. To get ready for the future, we're launching Joy Nation, and we need your support to do it. So help Joy by asking your workmates, your next-door neighbour, your mum, your dad, your siblings, and of course, your friends. Go to joy.org.au and make a donation to build Joy Nation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture, Saturday Magazine. Every Saturday, 10 till 12 on Joy 94.9.
And you are listening to Saturday Magazine with Macca and Tass on Joy 94.9. Macca.
I was just laughing, Tass, as you tried to pass your iPad through the...
glass screen.
Through the Perspex screen.
I hadn't
realised. Bit like now, an old tosser walking into a plate glass window. Anyway. Now, our next guest is Misha Ketchell. Misha is the editor of The Conversation, a regular guest. Good morning, Misha. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Look, you know, pretty good. We're in here, we're broadcasting, we're doing our job, you're doing your job. You know, I know you've been working from home for what seems like an eternity now. How are you coping with it?
Well, I've got to say that last Sunday was a difficult day, I think, for everybody.
Yes.
I think there had been some hopes that we would get out of this sooner than it looks like we're going to. But, you know, having said that, I think, there's been some nicer weather this week. We've hopefully all been getting out for walks. I don't know about you guys, but when I've been, you know, walking around town, I see a lot of people out and about, which I think is really good. And, you know, I think we're going to get through it. So I'm maintaining optimism.
We are certainly moving in the right direction. There's no question about that. It is going to bobble up and down a little bit, but it's trending in the right direction, I think.
Yeah. I wanted to start off, Misha. We've got a whole lot of things that we'd like to talk to you about, and I know you would too. There's been a lot of discussion about people that have been and how they've been treated, but people who've posted on social media about protests and how the police have responded to that. And I want to give our listeners a bit of a comparison. So if Misha on the Conversation website put an article up or an opinion piece that said, I'd like you all you freedom-loving blah, 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 to gather tomorrow at such and such a time, at such and such a place, to assert your rights. Misha is the author of that and also as the editor... would be guilty of incitement to break the law. If I said that on Joy, me as the presenter and also as the president, I would be, as president, I'd be responsible for it. As the person who said it, I could be charged with incitement. Now, where people, I think, perhaps don't understand what's happening, when they go, but I just posted it on Facebook... Well, what you're actually doing is it's the same thing. You're publishing it, to use a term. There is ample precedent in Australia for people who've said things on social media and they've been taken to court and they've been found guilty of an offence, whether it be libel or slander or whatever, and they've had to pay a penalty. So it's exactly the same as if you put it in The Age, if you put it on The Conversation, if you spoke about it on radio. It's not a private conversation. They're not necessarily liable for the same penalty, although it is incitement. So I was wondering, Misha, do you think people perhaps don't understand that by doing these things on social media, they're potentially breaking the law? Do you think people get it yet?
No, I don't. I think it's a real area of problem because social media occupies this grey zone between something like media, like what you are doing today on radio and what I do in The Conversation, where we have legal advice and we know that we have a range of very serious responsibilities as publishers of content to a wide audience. Social media can feel very much to the people participating in social media like it is a more private space or semi-private space or more informal space. It's in that grey zone. And unfortunately, the reality is, you're absolutely right, the legal consequences are the same. If you communicate something to a number of people via a digital platform, you know, whether it be incitement or defamation or any other legal consequence, you are legally responsible. But I do think that there is a difficulty because people tend not to understand that and they tend not to behave in that way. And I think that's partly why, you know, in my view, some of the policing of this has been a little bit, unfortunately, heavy-handed. You know, yes, you know, it is incitement. Yes, there are those legal consequences and some action is appropriate. But I think that there has been some valid criticism that the policing was just a little bit overly assertive and that there might have been a justification or an argument for a slightly gentler approach.
Mac is about to ask you a question, but it does go back to that old saying, you know, social media has turned everybody into a journalist now, hasn't it?
Well, it has, but without the training, right? So nobody is trained in defamation law or has the sort of experience that, you know, we all have having worked in the media for a long period of time. And these laws are complicated. I mean, even people who know them really well, I've studied law, I've got a law degree, I've worked in the media for 20 years, and still I will often call up legal advisors and get advice before we publish things.
Yes.
Now, how can somebody, like an ordinary person posting on Facebook, be expected to navigate that legal regime of that complexity? It's sort of, it's not fair on one level on individual people, I don't think.
But I was just sitting there in my flannelette jammies and I posted it on Facebook. How is that against the law?
Well, that's right, and I can sort of, but I can sort of understand that, Mac. I think that people have got a justifiable sense that, that, like, how can they be subjected to a law that is so complex that even, you know, senior legal advisors will disagree on its application and the rules? I mean, it is, it's a very detailed, sophisticated legal regime. There actually is some move to defamation law reform happening around Australia at the moment, which I think all journalists would welcome. And I'm not arguing for a lack of moral responsibility. I think that people who post on social media, and I think the social media platforms have made a lot of money out of being irresponsible in so many ways, whether it be QAnon or misinformation or not policing, not taking the responsibilities that they should as publishers. But it's just, my view is that you need to be, in a context of user-generated content, you've got to decide who you're going to hold responsible and how you're going to create that responsibility. And I would much rather see more of it placed at the level of the platform than sort of random policing of individuals who are posting things. Because I think that there is a legitimate argument that they are somewhat uninformed and don't have the tools to deal with these sort of complex legal questions.
Well, ignorance of the law is no excuse.
Well, that's right. Well, it, I mean, yes, that's true. That's what people say. But, of course, there are areas of law where it's impossible to know the law.
I think that's right, Macron. I think that's a very simplistic attitude. But I'm not having a go at you. I just do think it's a simplistic view. I often see people, and even people in my own network, who will get onto something like Facebook and actually incite people to participate in a conversation, be deliberately provocative, and sometimes make comments which are quite out there and invite people to participate in the conversation. Now, you know, that goes exactly to what, towards what you're talking about, Macca. You know, it is actually, you know, it's, I think it's borderline, to be honest.
And, you know, we've seen, you know, governments, you know, whether it's Scott Morrison pointing the finger at TikTok, you know, tapping away. The reality is governments have found it really difficult to regulate social media. So in a way, what is happening is, you know, Victoria Police understand what this platform is about and the reach that it has and why they need to step in. Now, we can have the discussion about the methods that they then use when they confront these people about it. And I agree with you. I think, you know, I felt pretty uncomfortable with some of that. I don't feel uncomfortable with recognising and acknowledging that social media is a platform, and it's the same as talking about on radio, on the news, on the television, in a newspaper, online. It's exactly the same, and it should be treated as such. If people don't understand that, I think that's unfortunate. But it's going to be a bigger issue in the years ahead, Misha. It's going to be a much bigger issue.
I think that's probably true. And, I mean, just thinking it through, there are probably some ways that you can deal with it, one of which is, I think, regulation and work with the social media companies. And I think one of the things that they need to do, and this really should be predominantly responsibility of the social media companies, is they should be doing a lot more to educate their users on what they can and cannot do, providing warnings, having systems to weed out this sort of information, you know, providing a structure around that so that you don't get a situation where someone unwittingly stumbles into a very heavy legal situation. Because I think that's unfair for everybody.
Well, you've been engaged, or you've been part of some discussions with the ACCC with regards to Google and other platforms and news. Some might say this is an attempt to regulate. I'd say it's actually about, from my perspective, about the people who create the content, and whether that's news or whatever, actually getting some compensation. When a platform carries your content, in some cases without attribution, and generates revenue from that, from ads and clicks, yet you get no part of it, I see that as grossly unfair. So you've been involved in some of those discussions, haven't you?
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting. What basically Facebook, if you take them as an example, and to a lesser extent Google, have done is they've made a lot of money out of getting people to pay attention to content that predominantly is not professionally produced, so it's user-generated content. And part of the way they've done that is by not taking responsibility the way that publishers and other professionals do for policing that content, for regulating it, for making it safe. They've been criticised for misinformation. They've been criticised for putting up things that are sort of vile and abusive and destructive in a whole bunch of ways. But their model has been, we're just going to design the best possible algorithm we can and get people to spend as much time on our sites as possible. What that's done is it's meant they've soaked up all the advertising revenue, and that means the media companies that try to practice professional media with fact-checking and a certain level of rigour around it basically can't afford to pay their journalists anymore. So that's sort of the reality. And then into this, what's happened is News Corp in particular, and we need to be sort of, you know, realistic about this, it has really been led by News Corp and to some extent the Nine newspapers and TV network, have put a lot of pressure on the government and said, these companies are soaking up all of the advertising revenue. They're making money out of our journalism. We want you to give us some of that money back. And the government, which has done what governments have always done when they're negotiating with media companies, is they've thought, if we keep these media companies happy to some extent, that helps us politically because, you know, there's always an election around the corner in Australia, and you always want to have good relationships with media companies. So the government has called in the ACCC ostensibly to regulate, to try to support public interest journalism, but partly, I think everybody can see that part of this has been about directing some revenue back to media companies that need to be appeased, that have been making a lot of noise about the way they've been treated. What's happened is the media, the digital platforms, Facebook and Google, have known that there's been efforts to regulate them in the past in other countries like Spain, France and Germany, and they've always kicked up a fuss. Now they're seeing it happening in Australia and they're terrified it's going to set a precedent where they're going to have to pay for the journalism that they post on their website, on their sites. So now what they're doing is Facebook is threatening to have a rule where you can't post any news on Facebook. So you can only post incitement and misinformation and whatever else you want. Yeah. You can't post actual news.
Facts.
Google is running a campaign where they're trying to scare the kids. So, you know, if you go on Google now, there's a thing saying that Google's under threat and that, you know, we're going to lose access to YouTube. Because they're trying to do exactly the same thing. These are big American companies. For them, Australia is a fairly small market. And they really don't necessarily care so much about what happens here, but they do care about setting a precedent. And they don't want to have any precedent where they've got to pay for content. So that's sort of where we're at. And unfortunately, it means that now there's sort of this standoff where both Facebook and Google are playing hardball in Australia. And they're threatening to do various things that will withdraw from the market.
Now, Misha, before we take a short break, what do you think should happen? What's your preferred point of view?
Well, my preferred... Look, I think the ACCC has done an excellent job in the parameters of this process, and they've introduced this idea that Google and Facebook have to bargain with media companies and pay them some money. I think that's pretty good. My criticism of the process is it could be better if it was based around the idea of actually thinking about how you support public interest journalism more generally. And I think a better model will probably be to tax the digital platforms and then distribute that money in the interest of public interest journalism and include the public broadcasters who are shut out of this process. So SBS and the ABC get no funding from Google or Facebook in this process, even though they produce a lot of very reliable, high-quality journalism.
Well,
I'm sure that if I contact Google and Facebook whether they'd actually place ads for Joy for free, seeing as though they don't pay for the other content, perhaps they could put ads for free. I might ask them that, I think.
Misha, we want to change the topic, if that's okay. Are you there?
Okay, I say that with tentatively.
Yes,
just waiting to see what you throw at me next.
we're wishing to have a chat with you about Stubbygate.
Stubbygate. Okay.
Stubbygate. This is Macca's terminology, of course. I asked Macca to come up with an interesting one-liner this morning to describe this whole fiasco. This is the intervention by the chief executive of Australia Post Melbourne City Council to ensure that stubby holders from Pauline Hanson made their way to the residents of the North Melbourne high-rise towers. What are your thoughts about all of that?
Well, look, it's interesting because what actually happened was Hanson wanted to send these stubby holders saying that she has the guts to say what you're thinking and then no hard feelings to the residents of the towers after she'd accused them of being alcoholics and drug addicts, which just makes me think, I mean, just that...
Who don't speak English.
I mean, the hypocrisy of that, of like basically attacking people, deriding them, and then expecting them to be like, oh, yeah, you know, no worries, it's all okay. You know, I find it pretty galling, like the whole sort of escapade of it. Having said that, what actually happened was Holgate, Christine Holgate, who's the CEO of Australia Post, directed her senior counsel to write to the City of Melbourne to get them to stop blocking the delivery of these parcels. And this was at a time when Australia Post was also negotiating with crossbenchers and wanting their support for some changes to the schedule for letter delivery. So there was a good reason for Australia Post to want to, you know, curry favour with One Nation. Having said all that, I read a really interesting article during the week by Bernard Keane on Crikey, who basically said, yeah, but at the end of the day, you know, you've got a right to have the letters delivered, and the idea of stopping this delivery by the Melbourne City Council was somewhat problematic. And I can sort of see that. I mean, you don't necessarily want people who might have political interests stopping the mail. So, you know, if Pauline Hanson had a list of those addresses and she's got her stubby holders and her notes, is the appropriate process that we stop her sending that stuff? No, I think you've got a right to use the mail in a reasonable way. Do I approve of what Pauline Hanson did? Certainly not. I think it was disgusting. That's sort of my
It's also not the job of the Melbourne City Council or the DHHS or Victoria Police or Ambulance Victoria or anyone else to actually place those parcels in the person's letterbox. It's actually not their responsibility. Now, Christine Holgate, who actually gets paid 4.9% of Australia Post's profit, like she gets 4%, almost 5%. Right? She's very well paid. I'm interested why she decided, you know, to tackle the Melbourne City Council. I think there's an element here that there's legislation coming up around Australia Post, and Australia Post needs Pauline Hanson's vote in the Senate. Well, they need a lot of the crossbench vote. But to me, why, you know, they're saying, oh, no, look, we just want to deliver it. Why did they threaten, you know, to the CEO of the City of Melbourne to report him to the police? I mean, for God's sake, Pauline, you know, whatever she's smoking, she needs to reduce the dose.
Yes, it's a pretty stinky story. Like, there's definitely, you know, a range of political motivations and sort of interest there that you can sort of start to ask questions about. And I think one of the other things, I mean,
it's also culturally inappropriate. I mean, let's look at that as well. I mean, sending stubby holders to, essentially a bunch of people who probably don't drink alcohol as well.
Oh, but you can put a can of soft drink in it, Tass.
Yes, you can.
Look, I think, you know, Australia Post grandstanded on this. We can only muse as to what the reasons are, but what it does is it just makes them look quite ridiculous. Quite ridiculous.
It does, yeah. It does, and particularly because there is, I mean, you've alluded to Christine Holgate's salary package, and before her there was Ahmed Zahour, who was also pushed out because of an incredibly large salary package. And there have been times in this process where Australia Post people have been asked to use their own car.
Yes,
voluntarily.
And we've actually got
volunteer time.
And we've actually got lots of emails about this morning, Misha, about what's happening to the posties and everything at Australia Post. And I speak to my postie; he's working in some cases a 12-hour shift, but not of his choice.
Mm. I think that's pretty disgusting once you see those relativities and the way those things are working. I just don't think you can justify it.
Okay, let's change topics again. The other topic that you were particularly interested in talking about was the role of experts in shaping public policy and public discourse.
Almost when grief meets politics.
Yes. Well, the reason I was interested in this was because I just feel like it's really come into sharp relief this week after the Andrews government's announcements on Sunday. There was the modelling that was produced as part of the justification for our path out of lockdown. And really, that modelling was used predominantly as justification for the idea that we need to be super careful, otherwise we're going to have another wave of COVID-19. And there has been some criticism of that modelling over the course of the week, and there's been some dissent amongst experts, and there's been some difference of opinion about what you can do and what you can't do. And I think it's really interesting because throughout this whole process of COVID-19, we've been very positive about the fact that politicians are finally listening to experts. We've seen chief health officers, chief medical officers. We've seen epidemiologists and virologists. We've actually seen a process where there's been sort of real, informed, nuanced leadership, and that's been a very good thing. And we're starting to see that fray a little bit as we're starting to see some dissent amongst the experts and some complexity. And Michelle Grattan wrote a great piece about it this week. She was touching on a controversy in Queensland with a decision where a woman wasn't allowed to attend a funeral, and basically talking as well about, you know, there's been the discussion this week about who's pushing for the curfew. And I think the really interesting thing about this is that if you want to have experts in public discourse alongside political leaders, and I think you do and you should, you do create an independent source of power. Like, there are going to be times when what the experts say aren't going to be exactly what the politicians want them to say. Sometimes they might say things that are uncomfortable, and sometimes they might disagree. And I think that we need to be robust and smart enough to be able to live with that and to be able to have that conversation in a sophisticated way. So, my personal view, and I'm pretty sure you both agree with this, I think the Andrews government overall has done an excellent job all the way through. I think it's really important that we're prudent and careful on our way out of this, you know, phase of lockdown. But I also do think it's important that there be a reasonable, sober, informed discussion around the nuance of what we do and don't do and how we do it.
I think you're right. I think you're right about that. And I'm butting in. I know Macca wants to ask you something, but I'm butting in because my partner has been showing me a series of Roy Morgan polls that have been showing that the approval rating for Andrew's performance and leadership around this has been in the 70s, which surprised me because I thought that, in fact, the community was much more divided around that. These are random polls by pollster Roy Morgan. They're only polls, I know that, and they're a sample of the population at a point in time. But, you know, the most recent one, which was sometime this week, showed again a approval rating of about 70%. So there's something, if there's truth in that,
There's some disconnect.
Correct.
I think, Misha, look, all of us, with varying degrees, want these decisions to be based on good medical grounds. And the argument about, for example, the curfew is it wasn't based on medical grounds. I make the point, at the end of the day, if you're out after 8 p.m. and before 5 a.m., there's only four reasons. So what the curfew does is it actually enables the police to enforce that more. When people aren't going to agree on this, but in terms of using the experts, what disturbed me is the Queensland Chief Medical Officer or Chief Health Officer made a decision that poor lady could actually go and view her father's body wearing full PPE, but that she couldn't go to the funeral. Okay, she made a decision based on medical risk, but when asked why there were these special arrangements, excuse me, for the AFL and for people like Tom Hanks, she said, oh, well, those people are bringing a lot of money into Queensland and we need the money at the moment. Well, you know, either you're basing a decision on health grounds or you're basing it on how much people contribute to the economy. And that's where, when these officials make comments like that, that I go, well, how can you then sustain stopping this woman going to a funeral? Should she have offered you $1,000? You know, should she have offered the state government $1,000 so she can go? Like, you know, come on. That's where I
think that's absolutely right. And I think that this is where you run into problems, where the fact that somebody is an expert who is bringing their expertise to a decision-making process, like a chief medical officer, where that actually ceases to be about the pure expertise and it becomes about something else. And you're talking about here about making judgments about bringing money into the economy. Well, that's really a political decision or an economic decision. But
and chief health officers aren't supposed to make them.
Correct.
That's right. So I think, you know, you put your finger on the problem. I mean, I would argue, and look, it's only a small point and it's only a very minor point, but I think that the modelling that the Andrews government used really predominantly on Sunday just to say we need to be very careful coming out of this.
Yeah.
One of the problems that you have with modelling is often it's produced to give permission for political decisions and modelling. It happens in all sorts of areas, whether it be should we build a highway or should we do this or that, because modelling, basically, you can get it to say whatever you want.
Exactly.
And the truth is that this particular modelling, which is published by the MJA and has been peer-reviewed, so it's all very rigorous, and there's nothing wrong with it per se, but it's sort of been structured as a permission mechanism or a justification for general government policy, which I think overall is the right policy, but it doesn't then allow those questions of nuance. So it basically says, if we open up, we risk another wave.
We do.
Rather than asking questions like, are there ways, for example, say in Gippsland, you know, which is outside the metropolitan area, where there's been very low case loads, we could open up in a way that manages risk, right? So there are some things which are very, which are sort of, if you take the experts and then you use them to justify all of your decisions, even decisions that their work actually doesn't explicitly justify, that's when you run into areas where we should be having a legitimate conversation.
Yeah. Misha, thank you so much. We're actually out of time. We are going to be talking about the roadmap and some other things with Stephen Duckett in the second hour. You might want to listen in.
He's terrific.
He is. Look, thanks for your work. And I did enjoy Michelle's article. In fact, I'm going to reread it this afternoon. Thanks for your work. Thanks for making the time. And hope your weekend is good.
Same to you, and happy lockdown.
Thank you.
Stay well.
Cheers.
Saturday Magazine is proudly sponsored by Velocity Rewards, the loyalty program of Virgin Australia.